I told him I was thinking of talking about shame, if someone had asked me to talk about. He said, "That's a great topic, but they're going to recoil." This is what he said. They're not going to be interested. So I'm going to jump in there and try to say some things about shame, and maybe you won't be interested. And one of the reasons it was suggested that I talk about it, and one of the reasons I was interested in talking about it, is that shame is considered to be one of the noblest virtues in Buddhism. And that, at least when I first heard about that, I thought that was pretty strange and unusual, that shame should be a virtue. When I was practicing with my first teacher in Thailand, I asked him at some point, why did you start practicing? I asked him, why did you become a monk? Because he became a novice when he was 12. He became ordained as soon as he was old enough to do so, I think at 18 or 20. So I asked him, at that young age, why did you take to Buddhism like that? And the response I got was, it was just through a translator. And the translator said that his reason why was because he had a very strong sense of shame and moral dread. And I said, oh. That was the first I ever heard of this pair of virtues called, often translated to English as shame and dread, moral dread. And I just went, oh, way above me. And since then, I've learned more about it. The Pali words are hiri and otapa. So I talked a little bit about hiri and otapa. And when I was thinking about this, I thought of all these words that are related to shame. Kind of the same family, perhaps. Shame and remorse and guilt and conscience and humiliation, embarrassment, dread, fear, regret, and disgrace. The ones I thought of. And then I want to tell you a story to start. I guess it's from the Desert Fathers, an old Christian story. And there was an abbot of a monastery named, if I remember right, Anastasius. Did I know him? Anastasius? Anastasius. And he had this beautiful book, maybe the Bible, written on some very precious parchment. The cover was kind of decorated with jewels, really beautiful, very wonderful book that he was quite happy in having. And it was worth 18 pence. And there was another monk staying or visiting his monastery who saw the book and at some point decided that this book was worth a lot, and so stole it and left the monastery. And went to town. And Anastasius at some point discovered his book was missing or stolen, and he decided not to do anything because he realized that theft was pretty bad, but he was worried that if he reported the theft and someone got caught, the man was caught, that then the man might lie, and lying is also considered pretty bad, and he didn't want to give the person the opportunity to even sin even more. So he didn't do anything. But anyway, so the man took the book to a bookseller, book buyer, in town, and he said, will you buy this for me for 16 pence? And the book dealer said, well, wait a minute. I have to go find out whether it's really worth that much before I pay you all this money. So go, why don't you come back in a couple of days? And I'll take the book and ask an expert and come back a couple of days, and it's worth that much, I'll give you that much money. So the book dealer took the book and went and asked Anastasius, how much is this book worth? And Anastasius saw the book and recognized it as his own, but he said, oh, it's a very valuable book. It's worth at least 18 pence. So you for sure you should give him 16 pence. So a few days later, the theft thief came back to the book dealer, and the book dealer said, oh yeah, I checked, and I checked with Anastasius. He said it's worth, you know, as much as you said, and I'll give you 16 pence. And the guy was flabbergasted. What? Did he say anything else? And he said, no, he just said that's what it was worth, and I should pay that for it. And then the thief said, oh, well, I can't sell it. I'm going to keep it, or whatever, I can't sell it. And he ran back to the monastery, to Anastasius, and said, you know, I apologize, and I confess, and I was the one who stole it. Won't you take it? Take it back. And Anastasius said, no, I'm going to keep it. Won't you keep it? And go on your way. And the guy said, I can't. If I keep it, I'll never have a moment of peace in my life again. And as the story continues, then the monk decided to stay there and became a student of Anastasius and stayed there and lived in the monastery. Was happy after, I guess. And I thought that was kind of a beautiful story. And perhaps it's an example of shame, of a kind of shame. That probably this thief was shamed by finding out that Anastasius, by the conduct of Anastasius, that Anastasius was able to discover that it was stolen, discovers his book, and was unwilling to press and demand it back. And from his shame, whatever emotion that he felt there, maybe shame is maybe a good word for it, he first was compelled to confess, and then to go even further and devote himself to religious life. I think when I first heard that shame was a moral virtue in Buddhism, I guess I was surprised because I had no concept of shame being a virtue. I thought of shame being very much related to guilt as being kind of an unfortunate emotion where you feel shame for yourself because you're kind of putting yourself down, you're abasing yourself, kind of a certain kind of self-effacement. And I think often because in our culture, people feel ashamed for many things which have nothing to do with their actions, you know, moral or wrong or right actions, but have to do with things like their physical appearance. People are ashamed about certain physical appearance. People have shame about sometimes their incompetence in certain areas. People are ashamed about their body often. Sexuality is a big area of shame in our culture. Imagine a man, imagine if maybe something just happened to you, discovered your fly's been down for a while. And sometimes you can just feel some kind of shame up in front of the classroom. And then I was reminded that the first emotion in the Bible, in Genesis, is shame. People ate the tree of wisdom, right? And they're supposed to get wisdom, what they got was shame. And I think a sense of shame, and shame I think is, that kind of shame, the way I was thinking of shame is very much culturally conditioned. The kind of mores of the culture. And different cultures have different precepts, different normative precepts by which we're supposed to live our life, and if you don't live your life along those precepts, then you feel ashamed sometimes. So if you were in the circle of students of Pythagoras, you weren't supposed to eat beans. And probably if you ate beans, you felt ashamed. And each culture has taboos that seem to have nothing to do with anything that seems, in our mind, reasonable. Certain cultures you're supposed to wear a veil. And if you don't wear a veil, then people feel, if someone sees your face, you feel ashamed. And also thinking that in a lot of books I've read on therapy, psychotherapy, and also a lot of books on spirituality, there's very little discussion of shame. And if there is any, shame is to be gotten rid of. Shame and guilt are considered to be unfortunate emotions. And the goal of therapy often is to overcome all sense of shame, all sense of guilt, and lack of worth, and incompetence. So you feel kind of wholeness and feel good about yourself, and can be perpetually happy. Maybe that's kind of a false caricature of therapy. But I think that there's some books that you read, kind of pop psychology books, are kind of caricatures maybe anyway of therapy. In a lot of religious traditions, shame is actually considered a virtue. And I looked into it a little bit. It isn't just in Buddhism, but it's also in Christianity and Judaism also. In Buddhism, these two virtues, hiri and otapa, are considered to be the two great guardians of the world. The world is protected by these two things. And it's also considered that the greatest wealth that a person can have is to have these two virtues. And also that the whole world somehow is dependent, kind of the linchpin of the world. The world kind of revolves around these two. Because without these two, there's very little to keep a lot of us from each other's throats. And there's enough of it, I mean, it's a miracle that you see what's going on in the world. I think it's pretty much a miracle that things aren't worse than they are. And I looked in different books this weekend, books in Buddhism, to see what's a good translation of these two words, hiri no tapa. And it seems like it seems very foggy in people's minds how to translate into English. Maybe that's because even shame in English is pretty vague emotion. Not so clear what it means even. But I think the best translation that I could figure out is that hiri is closely related to conscience. And otapa may be closely related to shame. And hiri has to do with is internal. It's your internal recognition and desire to avoid doing anything with any kind of wrongdoing. From some kind of internal motivation. And otapa is related to the word tapas, which is, some of you might know, is an Indian word meaning ascetic practices, austerities. Indian ascetics love to do tapas. So otapa has to do with feeling anguish, feeling some kind of inner anguish. But it's, I think it's best translated as shame because it comes from outside. It has to do with what you think or how you think other people will react to what you do. The reproach you receive from others. And that, is very much socially conditioned. But in the Buddhist tradition, they say that a person has a strong sense of otapa, a strong sense of shame. Doesn't have kind of shame, kind of normal, kind of conventional shame about what society might think, but has shame, feel shame about what the literal translation is, what the masters of faith will think of them. I guess what people who are quite developed people who are quite developed and mature in the spiritual path, what they will, how they'll react, how they'll see you. You're concerned about that. Maybe your spiritual friends, your sangha. Maybe not that. Maybe that you're not worried about that they'll judge you, but you just don't want to. You just don't want to have them see you in that light. You're kind of reluctant. And I believe that as a person practices mindfulness, as a mindfulness gets stronger, these two of so-called virtues or qualities tend to become stronger in people, kind of naturally. And certainly I think the first one, is a sense of conscience, or some people translate this one as shame, inner shame. I think as we become more mindful, the sense of separation between self and others begins to lessen in some way. And we become more sensitive to our effects we have on other people and the effect other people have on ourselves. And as we become more sensitive to how things affect others, I think we naturally don't want to do those kind of do things which cause pain and suffering for others. And also with mindfulness is also a increased sensitivity to, I think, our own shortcomings. I think that's fairly common with people. As you start becoming mindful of your internal states, you realize there's things in there which you're maybe not so proud of. And rather than thinking of that as being unfortunate, I think that often many religious traditions see that as being a fortunate step in maturity, spiritual maturity. When I was ordained as a Zen monk over 10 years ago now, I didn't expect there to be any change from the day before and the day after. I thought, I didn't really believe in rituals, or rituals had any effect. And I'll go through this ritual. That's what you do when you get ordained. You go through this ritual. But actually, I was quite surprised that the ritual actually had a big impact on me. And one of the things I noticed very quickly afterwards was that somehow, by becoming ordained, I became much more sensitive to my shortcomings. It was as if being a monk, I held myself up, or I saw myself in a different way than I saw myself before. And so I had kind of different expectations for myself. So I became more sensitive to what I considered to be my shortcomings. However, the nice thing was that at the same time that I became more aware of my shortcomings, it was more okay to have the shortcomings. Not that I was, I acted on them or anything, but I didn't feel some shame. I didn't feel bad about myself. I didn't criticize myself for having these shortcomings. I recognized them, and somehow it was okay. It was all held in some larger container. Somehow being a monk, I guess, is this larger container. You're wearing the Buddha's robes, you're part of the Buddha Sangha. And you're a child of the Buddha in some way. It's okay. One of the things I practiced in the years after I was ordained, I practiced trying to be an open book. I was living mostly in communities and monasteries. And I tried to not only answer any question anybody asked me about me, but without being obnoxious or something, I would let people know, my friends, whatever was going on with me. I was practicing not having any privacy, psychological privacy. Just wanted to be an open book. It meant being pretty vulnerable for a while. The other thing that the Buddhist tradition says about these two virtues is that they're the proximate cause, the near cause, for No, the proximate cause for these two virtues is self-respect and respect for others. And I think that's really neat, that the kind of shame that, and conscience that Buddhism is talking about developing comes from having a strong sense of self-respect. And that it's from self-respect that we have a sense of shame. So it isn't a sense of shame that comes from some external standards. Conscience doesn't come from the external standards that society kind of arbitrarily maybe comes up with. But rather we have some sense of who we are, some sense of our self-respect, a sense of personal integrity that somehow we don't want to transgress against because it's painful. If you feel your integrity, it's painful to transgress against it. I like the word disgrace because disgrace, I guess, is to go against our grace. And maybe grace is natural. Maybe grace is kind of more like a birthright. Grace is kind of like our self-respect. And when we shame ourselves, we disgrace, we go against our grace. And I think that as we practice, we get some sense of whether it's grace or integrity or self-respect, or sense of contentness or something. It tends to kind of come. And with that, I think, comes a increasing reluctance to transgress against it. So maybe a measure of whether shame is a virtue or a hindrance, psychological hindrance, is whether it comes, it's rooted in self-respect or not. Because often I think shame and guilt is experienced as kind of a self-criticism, as aversion towards it. We kind of hate ourselves or are disgusted with ourselves or putting ourselves down. I think the kind of shame that perhaps the Buddhists are talking about is a shame which actually in some ways supports our autonomy and supports our self-respect. When we feel shame, we feel motivated to align ourselves with our inner integrity. In my mind, I think of guilt as being kind of a stagnant emotion, kind of drains our energy. And I think of this conscience or shame that the Buddhists are talking about as being something which is actually energizing. It brings vitality. You feel that something's, you know, you feel some danger against your integrity and you're kind of motivated to do something about it. Not to transgress. In the texts, Buddhist texts that talked about this, they always talked about in the context of avoiding doing something in the future. They never talked about what happens if you've already done something. And I think there's a certain kind of shame that comes with that. And I think that maybe in this context, maybe the word remorse is better. Maybe in my mind, remorse is good because I don't really quite know what it means. It's kind of neutral. It's a neutral tone. And I think there's a sense of maybe like this monk who stole the book, of feeling somehow remorse, feeling regretful in some ways that you've done something wrong. But that remorse encourages you, propels you, then motivates you to kind of, in the future, to live more by your own inner integrity, your own inner sense of self-worth. So to find our inner worth and then to live by it. There's a story from the Zen tradition of a cook who was cooking a meal for the people on retreat in the meditation hall. And I guess he was cooking turtle soup. And so it was finished, and served it up in the meditation hall where the monks ate. And then he got a message from the abbot that he had to come into the hall. And he came up to the abbot, and the abbot was sitting there, and the bowl was in front of him. And a soup bowl, and he pointed, the abbot pointed to the soup bowl. And then floating in the top of the soup bowl was the head of a turtle. Somehow, when he cleaned the turtle, you know, the head kind of ended up in the soup. And the cook picked up the cook did was he picked up the head and he ate it and walked out. And this is, in Zen tradition, it's called eating the blame. Eating the blame. He didn't say he was sorry, he didn't apologize, he didn't defend himself, he didn't explain. He just, there was a problem. He acknowledged it, he ate the blame, and went on with his work. And then there's a story, allow me to tell you another story, of Hakuin. Hakuin was a Zen master from, I think, the 1700s in Japan. And he was living by himself in a temple, in a village, and a local 16-year-old girl got pregnant. And her parents insisted she tell them who the guy was. And at first she was kind of held out, and then finally she said, "It's Hakuin." She didn't really want to say who he was, but you know, the local priest, he was kind of an odd guy. He just blamed him. You know, it was the priest. So the whole town got angry, got up in arms, and, you know, chastised the monk. Said, "How can you do it?" Stopped kind of giving him alms. And all Hakuin said, when he was accused of being the father, he said, "Oh, is that so?" And then when the baby was born, the parents, kind of in anger, brought the baby to Hakuin's doorstep and said, "Here, you take it. You're the father." And he said, "Oh, is that so?" And then he kind of took the baby and took really good care of the baby, raising it, doing everything needs to be done for the baby. And after about a year, this girl had kind of misgivings about it all, kind of about her lying and everything. And said, "Well," she kind of confessed, actually, it was, you know, the apprentice to the shoemaker. And so then the parents came back to Hakuin and said, "Oh, we're so, so sorry. You made this big mistake, and we criticized you for something you didn't do. We're so, so sorry." And Hakuin said, "Oh, is that so?" maybe I don't explain the story. Maybe I shouldn't. This was a nice story. And then I'll finish maybe two short points. Is that maybe these virtues, shame and conscience, are worth thinking about a little bit, since the Buddhist tradition at least takes them very seriously. But one of the things that I think that people who are interested in mindfulness practice should do, kind of homework of some sort, I think it's useful, is to increase your vocabulary of words that have to do with emotions and sensations. So you can be more, you can start differentiating more carefully what is going on within you, in different emotions. So, I mean, I read this list of things that I kind of thought that could be overlapping each other in some way. Shame, remorse, guilt, conscience, humiliation, embarrassment, fear, regret, disgrace. There's probably more. I think there's shades of difference between some of these. And it's possible to kind of start being more careful, understanding more carefully what the differences are, and kind of increase, and I think that the greater vocabulary you have, the easier you are to kind of discern what's going on within you. It's like when I studied art, my art teacher, I was like shocked that there wasn't just, brown doesn't exist in the world of art. There's like, you know, 20 shades of brown, all of them have different names, a strange name, burnt sienna, and you have to learn them all, because they're all, you know, so you can recognize them, you know, what's needed. I think a good artist, a painter, I think, is able to recognize the different shades of brown. And I think a good mindfulness person can recognize the shades of their emotions. So that's kind of a suggestion as a little bit of homework. Think about emotions. And the other thing is, because a lot of I think it's emotional life is complicated. And I think the example of shame is an example of complication. A lot of emotions have two sides to them. The side which maybe is wholesome and the side which maybe is more unwholesome. And that one of the things that we can do as we're mindful is to start noticing the difference between a wholesome version of a particular emotion and an unwholesome one. Wholesome side of shame and the unwholesome side of shame. If we're still using the same, we're still willing to use the same word for a different, we will find better words. I suggest that you find your own criteria for deciding what's wholesome and unwholesome, but I'll suggest a few. One is, does it increase or decrease your sense of separation from other people? Do you feel more connected with people or less connected with people when you have this emotion? Or if you do this action? Does it bring energy or does it take away energy? Do you feel more uplifted or do you feel more kind of depressed or more downtrodden? The effect that actions and emotions have on us is one of the things that's very useful to pay attention to when you do mindfulness practice. You don't have to judge it without, you know, more than that, just to recognize what's going on. All of us have a real sense of personal worth, whether we realize it or not. And I think one of the aspects of mindfulness practice is learning to trust that and learning to rest in that. Rest in being content to finding our own self-worth, which we have already. It's not a matter of doing something. We already have it. So, I hope that it's okay to spend the evening talking about shame. We didn't recoil. None of you left. None of you seem to recoil too much. Thank you all.
And that is why you go down and take the car and go. We don't know where to go, but we just want to go in order to escape ourselves. The present civilization is it's such that we feel that we are free to confront ourselves. We like to forget ourselves. And we complain that we don't have leisure time. But every time we have leisure time, we are afraid to go back to ourselves. We would like to turn the television on in order not to go back to ourselves. Or we have to pick up the phone to talk to someone. Or you have to pick up an apple, or you use electronic games, or we take a drink of cognac. But we do everything in order to avoid consumption ourselves. And there are many, many things available for us to do so. Vietnamese refugees who come here, they have learned the habit of shopping, buying a lot of things. Every time they have some spare time, they want to go shopping. And they buy a lot of things that their house are there's no room left in the house. And one day they saw a beautiful Buddhist statue, and they wanted to buy it too. I don't blame Buddhists for buying Buddha statue. But some of them, upon bringing the Buddha statue home, did not find any place to put. And then they saw the television set, which is quite nice, quite lit on the top. So they say, why not put it on the television set? But you know, the television set and the Buddha statue, these two things cannot go together. The television set is to help you to forget yourself. And the Buddha statue is to help you to go back to yourself. And how can these two things reconcile? And when we use our car, we use it like our television set. We want to run away from us. By using our car in that way, we contribute into the destruction of our planet, because in the last 5 years we have killed hundreds of millions of hectares of forest land. In Northern Europe, in Northern America, we have killed a lot of forest land. And as a Buddhist, I know that in my former life, have been trees and clouds and rocks. And I know that by practicing meditation, I see that I continue to be trees, bush, flowers, vegetables. And I know that if the trees are not able to live, humans are not going to live very long. And we have used our cars so much that the acid rain has killed a lot of life on this planet. Where I am going, do I know? I am going to my own destruction, or the destruction of my beautiful planet. That is the practice of mindfulness. Before I start the car, I breathe in and breathe out according to the Dharma. Before I start in the car, I know where I go. If I am to go to my destruction, and then I don't like to go, I see that I do not really need the car, that is why I take the key out and put it in my pocket, and I go practice walking meditation. Practicing walking meditation is a very healthy and joyful practice. I make steps very peaceful, very happy, because I don't believe that my happiness is at the destination. I know that life can only be possible in the present moment. Therefore, each step I make brings me back to the present moment where I can encounter life. And each step like that makes me joyful and happy. And it's much better than driving a car when you don't really need it. The car and I are one. It means that we usually think of ourselves as the master, and the car is only an instrument. And we are quite powerful. The car cannot do anything harmful to us, but that is not true. With our instruments, we become quite different. You know, a good musician with his guitar, they can become more influential, more important. If a person has a gun in his hands, they become very dangerous. And we know that the humankind has become a very dangerous species on Earth, because they now have the means to destroy life on Earth. We have more than 50,000 nuclear warheads, but we still want to make more. Sometimes we remember that we have so many of them already, and we may be scared to death. But why do we continue to make more? That proves that we are not really master of our situation. In the Buddhist circle, we used to tell the story of the man riding a horse very quickly. The horse was galloping very quickly. And the man on the horse seemed to be very busy. He may be going to somewhere where he has some important thing to do. And another person standing on the sidewalk yelling at him, "Where are you going?" And that man yelled back, "I don't know. You ask the horse," he said. It sounds funny, but it is exactly our situation, because we don't really know where we are going. Because why we already have such a 50,000 liter wide, and it still continue to make more, it's impossible for us to stop. It means we cannot control our situation. One day, it maybe because our fear, our panic, we will use these nuclear bombs in order to destroy life on Earth. The car and I are one. If the car goes fast, I go fast. It means that if we don't practice mindfulness, if we do not know what is really going on, and then life will not be possible for us and for our children. That is what I call the practice of engaged Buddhism. It is only the practice of mindful living in our everyday life. We have the tendency to think of happiness as something in the future. That is why we forget the present moment. And that is why we destroy the present moment for the sake of the future. We don't know that life can only be found in the present moment. And if we take good care of the present moment, we will take good care of the future. And therefore, taking refuge to the Buddha, in the Buddha, means to take refuge in the present moment. Mindfulness is practiced not in the future. Mindfulness is practiced in the present moment. The moment when you begin to breathe in and out in mindfulness, you go back to the present moment. You make an awakening, you make understanding possible. And where understanding and awakening is possible, well, the way is clear, the path is clear, you know where you are. A path that will lead to peace and happiness. And therefore, the moment when you begin breathing in and out, in mindfulness, you make awakening possible in the present moment. You take refuge in the Buddha in the present moment. And that is why I like to repeat to you, taking refuge in the Buddha is to take refuge in the present moment. When you take care of the present moment well, you also take care of the future. And this is the message brought to us by the Buddha. Is simple, it's clear. You practice Buddhism by throwing the banana skin into the garbage can. You practice Buddhism by holding your child in your arms, breathing in, "He is with me," breathing out, "I am happy," so that you and your child both become real in the present moment. When you bring a cup of water up to drink, you breathe in and out to make the cup of water real. When we practice deep meditation, we spend 1 hour together just drinking one cup of tea. Because we need the time to be with the tea. In a coffee shop, you might take some tea or some coffee. But because the fact that you think are the business to do, you, the fact is that people are talking a lot, and then they hit the music, the tea is not very real. But in a tea meditation session, you bring the tea up like this, you breathe, and you make the tea real. The tea has to regulate its highest position in the world as tea, because the tea is as marvelous as Buddha. And when the tea has become real, you also will become real. And when both of you encounter life is possible. So mindfulness is practiced during eating, during drinking, during walking, during washing. And mindfulness shows you what to do and what not to do. That is why I said that compassion in action is important, but compassion in non-action is equally important. What you do not do can determine the fate of the world. Just refrain from doing a number of things and you can already save us from the people. To live mindfully is to be with light, with compassion, with peace. And even if you don't do anything yet, you are very helpful. Imagine a person sitting on a boat crossing the ocean. The Vietnamese refugees call boat people. They very often experience this. Very often they are caught in a tempest. Remain calm, and then the situation will be different. Because he or she is calm, she or he can inspire confidence, and people will listen to him or her. She will tell them what to do and what not to do. People make the boat sink because they do things that are not supposed to be done. If they just stay quiet, then the boat will have a chance to survive. So in our world, we need a number of people who stay calm, who stay serene, who inspire faith and confidence. And many Buddhist sutras agree that you are that person. You should be the person that should inspire us with calm, tranquility, and trust. And that can be done by practice of mindfulness. When you practice mindfulness, you become quiet, you become serene, you become joyful, you become happy. And even you have not done anything, your presence is a positive contribution to peace. Suppose I am a person who used to drink a lot of liquors. And suppose someone introduced to me the practice of Buddhism. And he would tell me like this, well, I wouldn't say that you have to stop drinking whiskey before you can practice Buddhism. I only ask you to drink whiskey with mindfulness. That's my way of teaching. I don't impose conditions. I said, well, drink your whiskey, but please do it in mind. And then you bring up your whiskey, look very deeply into the whiskey, know that I am holding the whiskey, I see the whiskey, and if you practice seriously enough, you will see very deeply into the nature of whiskey. You see that in order to make whiskey, in order to make meat, Western people have spent a lot of grain. And people in the third world, many are dying because of the lack of food. And the amount of grain that Western countries use to make meat and alcohol is just enormous. And these people, we are told that if only Western countries reduce the eating of meat into 50%, by 50%, or refrain from drinking alcohol by 50%, that would be enough to change the face of the world. And if I drink my whiskey mindfully, looking deeply into the nature of my whiskey, one day I will see that. And if I see something like that, that is insight. Insight is the fruit of my meditation. To meditate means to stop and look deeply. First, you have to stop. Like when you do a mathematical exercise, you have to stop looking at the television. You have to stop talking. You have to stop doing things so that your mind can be concentrated on the mathematical problems. The same thing is true with meditation. When you meditate, you have to stop meditating in order to be for concentration to be possible. And the second thing you do is to look deeply into what you are meditating on, because to meditate is always to meditate on something. In the case of our friend who is drinking whiskey, he is meditating on whiskey. And he is trying to look into the true nature of whiskey. And he will find out that people are starving, their brains are being used to make alcohol, and drinking some whiskey like this is to kill people in the true world. And when one has that kind of insight, he or she will stop drinking like that. So if we do not have the insight, we cannot have compassion. And if we do not have compassion, we cannot translate our compassion into the kind of action that will help relieving the suffering in the world. Compassion is a kind of energy. You know, anger also is a source of energy, but a rather destructive kind of source of energy. Compassion is like anger. It is energy, but it is not destructive. With compassion in yourself, you can have the strength to remove suffering and to offer happiness. But in order to have compassion, you need something else. You just cannot have compassion like that. And the meditation on compassion is an art in the Buddhist practice. And to my understanding, compassion is generated by understanding. If you do not understand, there is no way for you to love. Two persons, like a husband and wife, imagine a couple who do not understand each other. It's impossible for them to love each other. The more they love, the more they make the other person unhappy. This is very clear in Buddhist teaching. Understanding, if you want to love someone, you have to understand the suffering, the anxiety, the problems, the difficulties of that person, the aspirations of that person. Otherwise, don't tell me that you love that person. There are those of us who say that I love him very much, but I can believe that person that he has the willingness to love. But it is a fact that the more he loves, the more he makes the other person suffer. And therefore, in Buddhist teaching, understanding is the basis of love. Understanding is the other name of love. If you don't understand, you cannot love. And where does it come from, understanding? Understanding comes from meditation, from looking. If you do not look deeply into your son, you cannot understand your son, and you cannot love him. Therefore, those who practice the art of loving have to go back to their son, taking his hand, holding his hand, and ask, son, Do you think I understand you? Do you think I love you properly? Do I make you suffer because of my love? Well, that is the way to open the door of understanding. If tonight you go home and take the whole hand of your wife and you ask that question, darling, you think I understand you? You think that my love is making you suffer? Please tell me so that I can love you in a way that Buddha teaches me. And if your wife begins to cry, and then the door is open for happiness to be possible. So to meditate does not mean that you close yourself in a meditation hall. To meditate is to look deeply at everything in your daily life in order to see the real nature. And once you see the real nature of things, you begin to understand that that is insight, that is enlightenment. And insight and enlightenment bring about compassion and true love. You know that there's no doubt that during the war in Vietnam, the United States of America wanted to help Vietnam. But we were not understood. We were not happy. Caught in a war of ideologies between a communist bloc and an anti-communist bloc, we try our best to tell you, to tell the world that we don't want the war, we don't want killing of each other. Weapons that we had in Vietnam came either from China, from Russia, or from the United States. We did not manufacture any weapon at all. We did not manufacture ideologies either. Both things came from the outside, and we didn't want the war. But both sides pushed us together and push us to kill ourselves. We try our best to say that we don't want it. Please let us alone. But amidst the sound of bombs and mortar, our voice was lost. And you thought that we need you very much. We need the Russians, we need the Americans very much. We need not really. And some of us have to burn ourselves alive in order to hope that the message will come across. And still you did not understand. You thought that we were trying to do some political things by burning ourselves. When you don't understand a person, you have no way of knowing him or her. That is the vision of the Buddha as I see it. And in order to understand, you have to be yourself and to look deeply into the person you want to know. I was in India last December with 36 friends from different countries. And we all had different views on India. And a number of our Western friends were obsessed by the idea that India is too poor. They didn't know that children makers are a product of Western tourism. When you go to the countryside, you see very healthy and happy children. They never do like this to beg for 1 rupee or 10 rupees. And if you think that all children in India are like those around Bodh Gaya, and then you are mistaken. I saw a young man who tried to sell something to a tourist, and he pretended that if he could not sell that to him, his family will starve that night. As I observed, I saw it very clearly. But the tourist did not buy it, so he left the tourist, he turned around, and he sang very happily the song. He sang very happily to himself. And then when I saw two rickshaw drivers collide, I saw both of them laughing at each other, and then went on their way. They did not dispute. It seemed that they thought that nobody wanted that kind of accident, so it's better each one to go him all the way. And people were quite relaxed, not like in the West. If something happened like that in the West, there would be a lot of fighting or arguing. And I saw that Hilton Hotel will be, I don't remember exactly the name of the hotel, but a hotel of that kind of standard will be built very close to Bodh Gaya. And I don't think that it is a good thing for the children in that area. Living with the children, being in contact with them, I feel that the children are happy. And I received a kind of happiness, the smile. And now foreigners are coming and telling them that there is another way of life that is of higher standard. I think that you change the idea of the children in the area, and the children will abandon their way of happiness, the way to live simply and happily. So even if we have the good intention to help, we might harm people if we don't really understand people. It's not because we have a lot of money that we can make people happy. And this is what I have learned. Because when Americans were in Vietnam, much destruction had been caused and was caused by money. There is a lot of corruption because of the dollars. And therefore, compassion in action means understanding in action. Without understanding, compassion would be impossible. Therefore, our practice, and in order to see and to understand deeply our situation, and the situation of the people we want to help, that is very important. And once we can see the real need of the people, the real aspiration of the people, and if we can help the people to be happy in their own way, therefore, by that time, we could make compassion into something real. I would like to go back to the problem of means and ends. Usually we think that what we do now in the present moment is a means to achieving an end. That end being happiness, or joy, or liberation. But the Buddhist teaching, as I understand it, tell us that there is no difference between means and ends. the means are the ends by themselves. When you practice mindfulness, you realize enlightenment, you realize joy and understanding right away at that moment. You don't need to practice 10 years or 20 years in order for the enlightenment and joy and happiness to be possible. No. 1 minute of practice of mindfulness can bring already joy and understanding. Because enlightenment is the same thing with mindfulness. And therefore, there is no way to enlightenment. Enlightenment is the way. Live your present moment in an enlightened way. That is enlightenment. And enlightenment can be made possible each moment in our life. The same thing is true with peace. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Each step you make, each word you say, each act you take should be peace. Don't consider them as means. They should be the end by themselves. There is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. Make a step and be happy. Say a word and be happy. Take a look and you be happy. And therefore, happiness, joy, enlightenment should be realized in the very moment, present moment. And that is what I see in my practice. I would like to end this address with a story, the story of a river. Once upon a time, there was a stream of water born from the top of a mountain. She went down very quickly, thinking that her destination is the great ocean. And although she danced a lot, she sang a lot, she was not really happy, because we know that the awareness of happiness is the basis of happiness itself. A person is not happy if he or she is not aware that he or she is happy. So, when the stream of the river, of the, when the stream of water comes to the lowland, it could not run very quickly any longer. It has to slow down, and it suffered because it see that that way the river cannot arrive at the ocean very quickly. And winding through the lowland, the river begins to notice that there are clouds reflecting in the river. And now she spends all her time shaving off the clouds. Clouds are beautiful. Clouds are of different kinds of shapes, different kinds of colors. But she suffers because clouds do not seem to be very stable. They don't want to stay all the time at one place. And every time a cloud departs, the river cried, and she blamed the flood to the clouds as not being faithful. And one after another, the clouds leave her and go away, so the river learned to suffer a lot. One day there was a storm that take away all the clouds in the sky, and the sky was completely empty. The river thought that she could not go on with her life. Life is meaningless without the clouds. There's nothing to run after at all. So she wanted to commit suicide. But you know, it's very difficult for a river to commit suicide. That night, she had the opportunity to go back to herself. No class to run out. So she had the first opportunity to go back to herself and to listen to her cry. You know, the sound of the water against the banks of the river. And because of that opportunity of going back to herself, she found out something very important. That the river herself is only water. The river is only made of water. And water is nothing except clouds. What she has been chasing after is already within herself. She doesn't have to run after anything else. So she feels something very peaceful for the first time in herself. She doesn't feel the need to run after something else. And therefore, she saw the ocean within herself. She doesn't need to arrive anymore. And she began to taste the happiness and the peace of the paradise. The next moment when she opened herself, she saw a wonderful thing, the blue sky, for the first time. Because in the past she did not pay attention to the blue sky that is so peaceful, so serene. She only paid attention to the clouds. She didn't know that the blue sky is the house of every cloud. But seeing the blue sky, she experienced the kind of bliss, the feeling of peace, of happiness, of something permanent. And that afternoon, the storm ended and the clouds came back to her. Now she was able to grip the clouds with equanimity. As the cloud comes to her, she waved and smiled at the cloud. And when the cloud wanted to say goodbye, she just smiled and waved to the cloud. No suffering any longer. And you know how happy she is with that attitude of non-attachment, of non-pursuing. I would like to tell you that in Buddhism there is the practice of apranahita. Apranahita means wishlessness, one of three doors of liberation. The first being emptiness, the second is marklessness, and the third is wishlessness. Apranahita. It means that you don't put in front of you something and you run after that. In Mahayana Buddhism, that teaching has been developed fully into the teaching of non-attainment. There is no attainment because there is no object of attainment. You don't need anything. You have everything within yourself, including Buddhahood, enlightenment. You don't have to run after anything else. So in the Heart Sutra that we just chanted three times during the ceremony of bathing the Buddha, there is no attainment because there is no object of attainment. So she realized that, therefore she felt at peace. That evening when she opened her heart to the sky, she received a very beautiful moon, the full moon within herself. Never the moon so beautiful. And that is the full realization. Imagine that night that the clouds are taking, holding the hand of the moon, and the moon holding the hand of the river. They practice walking meditation. Enjoy the better moment. Ladies and gentlemen, I have said that we should practice mindful living in our daily life in order to know what is really going on. We don't have to go to India, to Malaysia, to Cambodia in order to see the situation there. We just stay here and we look deeply at our being and we can see everything elsewhere. When I pick up my empty plate in order to fill up some food, I used to look at the empty plate and read. I say something like this: my plate is empty now, but I know that in a few moments it will be filled with good food. That's my practice of meditation. That means that why I only need a few moments in order for my plate to be filled with food, I know that millions of children and adults, they hold the empty plate for a long time and they won't have anything to do to eat in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 days. I remember that 40,000 children die every day in the world. 40,000 children die every day in the world because of the lack of food. So while holding the empty plate here, I see the situation of the world. I don't have to travel. And there is a family, Buddhist family, living in Houston, Texas. Before eating, they sit around the table, they practice breathing. They practice looking at their empty plate. And then each person, each child, will take out 10 cents and put in a box on the table, remembering those children who are starving in the world. That is good practice of mindfulness. You enjoy your food, but you also see what is going on in the world. So the fact that child put 10 cents in a box for the food of another child in the third world, that is good practice of mindfulness. So we live mindfully our daily life, and that will show us what to do and what not to do. And our brothers and sisters who are working mindfully everywhere in the world will be contacted by us. They are everywhere. They live mindfully their life in a very engaged way. They are helping children and other people who are suffering. And it is possible that we can be in touch with them. And my principle is that we should live our daily life in such a way that life is possible elsewhere in the world and also in the future for our children and grandchildren. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to end here by asking you to pay attention to the fact that monks and nuns and others are suffering in this present moment in Tibet. Please nourish your awareness that our brothers and sisters are suffering in Tibet. And try to live in such a way that can help relieving the suffering. And also monks and nuns and other intellectuals and artists are suffering in Vietnam. Monks and nuns are being held in prison in Vietnam. So please remember that also in Bangladesh, and in Bangladesh, many Buddhists are suffering in the hills of Bangladesh. And not only the Buddhists, the non-Buddhists do suffer also. And to practice mindfulness is to remember in the present moment suffering, the kind of suffering that will help us to grow steadily into a human being. For Vietnam, there is a table of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. We have prepared a letter for you to sign, asking very kindly the program of Vietnam to allow monks and nuns in prison to go home in order for them to practice Buddhism. During the war in Vietnam, I wrote a song on the suffering of the Vietnamese people. I voiced my hope that a Buddha would be born in Vietnam soon, so that our country will be saved by the Buddha. And I know that in America, we also need a Buddha right now. In Tibet, we do need a Buddha now. And in Cambodia, we do need a Buddha. We need a Buddha everywhere. And so I have come to realize that we should make the Buddha real in every country, with everyone. And this is possible with the practice of mindfulness. Thank you very much for
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to share with you some of my experiences in the practice of Buddhist meditation. I think Buddhist practice of meditation begins with breathing in and breathing out. And it will continue with the breathing in and breathing out for a long time, because the breathing is very enjoyable and it makes life possible in the present moment. When you breathe in a deep breath, you say, breathing in, I'm going back to myself. And when you breathe out, you say, breathing out, I smile. And that can have a wonderful effect on your life, not only in the present moment, but in the next moment. Breathing in, I go back to myself. This is to restore your person, to make it alive, to be yourself again, because in our daily life, we may be dispersed. Sometimes our body is here, but our mind is elsewhere. And we are possessed either by the past or the future, or by anger, or by anxieties, and so on. We are not really ourselves. But the moment you begin to breathe in, consciously breathing in, I am going back to myself, well, something miraculous happens. You recuperate your own person. You are yourself again. And when you breathe out, you say, breathing out, I smile. Smiling, it means that you are in control of the situation. You are smiling of yourself. You are making yourself relax. You know that you have sovereignty over yourself now. And that moment, it is possible for you to encounter life in its entirety. Suppose someone comes to you with a flower, which is a very nice thing. And if you are still possessed by your worries about the future or your regret about the past, and you are not yourself, so you have no capacity to receive the person with the flower. And the person might be only a ghost, the flower also a ghost. Life is not existing in that moment. Therefore, breathing in, I go back to myself. Breathing out, I smile is a wonderful practice that makes yourself into a whole person again. I have been a Buddhist monk for more than 45 years, and I still enjoy that breathing in and breathing out. And I think that is one of the things that I consider to be very precious, and I would like to share with you right away. Sometimes we forget to go back to ourselves, and life just disappears. And therefore, in a Buddhist temple, we use a bell in order to remind ourselves of breathing and going back to ourselves. As a novice, I had to learn to go back to myself right in the beginning. I was told that every time I hear the sound of the bell, I have to stop my thinking, stop talking, and hold on to my breathing and go back to myself. Listen, this wonderful sound brings me back to my true self. And by doing so, I make life possible in the present moment. And life is sometimes awful, but life is also wonderful. And going back to ourselves, we have the chance to be in touch with life in its awful aspects and also in its wonderful aspects. We have to suffer in order to become a real human being, but most of our sufferings are useless. But in the Buddhist teaching, we know that we have to be in touch with suffering in order to know what is really going on in ourselves and around us in the world. Because if you don't know the situation of the world, the suffering in the world, you cannot be really a human being in its real meaning. But I had said that most of our sufferings are entirely useless because we have created this kind of suffering to ourselves and to people who live around us. And the practice of mindfulness, that is the good, the practice of mindfulness through mindful breathing is one of the wonderful ways to go back to yourself in order to stop this kind of useless sufferings. And you only like to suffer in order to be with the suffering of the world. Compassion means to suffer together with other people. And that suffering, that compassion can only help you to grow and to be fully a person. But suffering is not enough. We cannot live by suffering alone. Therefore, we have to live with joy and with happiness. And joy and happiness are possible with mindful breathing. When I go back to myself, I feel that I am a wonderful entity of life. I feel that elements of happiness are everywhere within me and around me. For instance, I know that I have eyes that enable me to see all sorts of colors and forms. And if I am aware of that, I open my eyes and I see the blue sky, the beautiful flowers, the beautiful eyes of my child, and so on. And happiness is possible with the presence of mindfulness. You know that every time you have a toothache, you are enlightened. You know something very well. You know that not having a toothache is a wonderful thing. But when you do not have one, you don't seem to be very happy. And that is our fault. We are happy all the time, most of the time, but we don't know that. And therefore, to have eyes, not to have a toothache, to have a nose that can breathe, not to have asthma, to be able to walk on our beautiful planets, all these things are positive elements of our happiness. But we are not aware of that, of these. Because we are always stuck to the future. We believe that our happiness in the future. We look for everything in the future. Our peace should be something in the future. Happiness should be something in the future. Nirvana is in the future. The kingdom of God is in the future. But according to the teaching of Buddhism, everything should be sought for in the present moment. Nirvana, happiness, joy, the kingdom of God. If you miss the present moment, you have nothing. One day the Buddha was standing in front of a community of 1,250 monks, and he was holding a flower like this without saying anything. And the audience was perfectly still, silent. everyone was trying to find out what is behind that kind of gesture. And everyone was thinking very hard. And the Buddha stood like that for a long time. And after, I think, about 10 minutes, he smiled. He smiled because someone there in the audience smiled to him. One out of 1,250 people, one person smiled. And the Buddha said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have a treasure of insight, of wisdom. I have transmitted it to Mahakashyapa, the monk who bear that name, who smiled at the flower." He was smiling at the flower because he was not thinking. He was breathing and smiling, and therefore he could have a direct contact with the flower. When someone holds a flower and shows it to you, it's very clear that he wants you to be in touch with the flower. And if you continue to think, to try to find philosophical meanings behind that, you miss the flower. So the practice of mindfulness is to go back to yourself in the present moment and not being barred, not having the thinking of as an obstacle, not having the worries as an obstacle, not having hope as an obstacle. Because there are many obstacles to our happiness and joy in the present moment, including wealth, including our intellectual luggages. And therefore, we have to learn how to liberate ourselves of all these things in order to be really alive in the present moment. If you practice breathing in, I go back to myself, and breathing out, I smile. You see that the first function of conscious breathing is to stop your thinking. And this is very important. Many of us think too much, so to the point that we cannot sleep during the night. There is a cassette tape in our head. It's turning all day long. And that is one obstacle for our being alive. To be or to think, you have to choose between the two. And Descartes seemed to be very proud of him when he said, "I think, therefore I am, but thinking is less than being. That's my experience." If you think, you miss the flower. If you think, you miss your child. If you think, you miss the most wonderful things in life. I don't mean that thinking is a bad thing, but most of our thinking is useless. The second function of conscious breathing is to help you to recuperate yourself, to make you ready to encounter with life. When you stop thinking, you are ready to be in touch with life. And you can live deeply each moment of your life. So I remember that when Jesus...